All Down Piccadilly from the Arcadians by Lionel Monckton. Richard Stewart was joined by the New London Light Opera Orchestra, the New London Light Opera Chorus and the New London Orchestra, conducted by Ronald Corp. And that's all for this Sunday morning. Rob's back next weekend, and once again, we're coming live from London's South Bank Centre. Do join him if you can for Mozart's Jupiter Symphony and the Brahms Piano Quintet, the first in a short season of such quintets, a great piece. Meanwhile, have a music-filled week. I've certainly got a lot lined up with the LSO tonight and the LPO here at the Royal Festival Hall on Wednesday. And that concert, which contains two of the most popular works for organ and orchestra, Poulenc's Concerto and Saint-Saëns' Third Symphony, will be broadcast live on Radio 3. I can't wait. I'm James Jolly. Thanks for your company. And I'll be back on Easter Day with some appropriate music and also a few rarities. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3. And my producer today at the South Bank was Neil Miners.
You love listening to Radio 3? Well, come down and watch live an afternoon of classics, film music and jazz at London South Bank Centre. In Saturday Classics at 2, the National Theatre's director, Nicholas Heitner, presents a personal selection of music by Bach, Mahler and many others. And in Sound of Cinema at 4, I'll be focusing on music for the silent movies, and the classic score of the week is Charlie Chaplin's music for City Lights. And then it's your turn, Alan Shipton, with live requests for all types of jazz. Jazz record requests at 5 p.m. Radio 3 live at South Bank Centre. Come and join us next Saturday, starting at 2 p.m.
This is BBC Radio 3. Now it's midday and time for Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest today is the satirist Craig Brown.
I'm in a glass box this week with somebody who spends his life scribbling away in a darkened room in his pyjamas. For 25 years now, Craig Brown has been one of our funniest satirists, mocking the rich and the famous, poking fun at celebrity culture. He's dressed today, or at least half-dressed, to come to London's South Bank Centre to play us some of the music he finds moving and inspiring, and some stuff he just finds funny. Welcome to Private Passions, Craig.
Thank you.
The list of people you've parodied is pretty exhaustive. David Cameron, Katie Price, Virginia Woolf, Tony Benn, the Queen. Hundreds, maybe thousands of different voices over the years. So presumably you're always looking for new targets.
Yes, but they come along pretty rapidly. In fact, increasingly rapidly, because there are more and more celebrities growing every week. It's kind of a magical garden. And so I don't have to look far. And then also there are new media for celebrities to make idiots of themselves on. A particularly rich one is Twitter. So I've now started raiding Twitter, where people might not be imbeciles, become imbeciles by going onto Twitter. One of my most recent targets was Yoko Ono, who tweets these words of sort of Buddha-like wisdom, which are in fact very banal. So I just invent these tweets. For instance, this is her on the idea of ladders. A ladder is for climbing up as well as climbing down. Before you climb up a ladder, remember to check it has rungs. So that's kind of thing. And so they write themselves in a way. They're my little band of helpers.
Given your satirical bent, I was slightly surprised by this first choice of music.
Yes, well, I was in a prep school, boarding prep school in the 60s, and we had to sing these Catholic hymns, and Catholic hymns are even drearier, as you probably know, than Anglican hymns. And then suddenly, in 1967, when I was 10, this record by the Edwin Hawkins singers came into the top 10 miraculously, and I suddenly realised that hymns could be fun and joyous.
Oh, a happy day.
Oh, a happy day.
Oh, a happy day.
Oh, a happy day.
When Jesus wore. Oh, when he wore, when Jesus wore, washed my sins away.
Oh, happy day,
oh, happy day. happy day.
Oh, a happy day.
Oh, a happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
The Edwin Hawkins Singers with Oh Happy Day. Do you steer clear of parodying religion, Craig?
Well, yes. If I lived in America, where it's much more prevalent and carries a lot of weight, I'd definitely be against that kind of religion, TV religion. But here I'm more against, because we're a slightly godless country or leaning towards godlessness, I'm more against the kind of militant atheists. So I think they're in the ascendancy. I'm all for attacking the big guys, and at the moment they are Dawkins and Grayling and people, because I think they're becoming sort of Pied Pipers of Hamelin for the young, and I don't see what's wrong with religion. And also, I mean, Richard Dawkins is another person who tweets miraculously. One of his recent tweets, and this is real, though it could have been my parody, Stalin probably not religious, but his beliefs were irrational enough to be called religious. Well, that is completely unfair. It's a sort of circular art. So I did some parodies of his tweets. Francis of Assisi hated birds, carried a concealed gun. As a scientist, I would need proof that he didn't.
Well, I thought a perfect parody for Radio 3 would be your parody of W.G. Zabolt. A very fashionable writer now, with a pronounced Germanic philosophical bent. And I think in Aubra, where you live, they organise entire weekends just to talk about him and commune with him spiritually. And here he is, buying an ice cream on the beach. And we'll give you some seaside sound effects to start you off.
The sky loomed over me like a bright blue package containing heavy objects about to fall on the world from a very great height. Strawberry or orange, mate, said the man. I had asked for an ice lolly, and now the salesman in the van was cross-questioning me as to my exact meaning. A mivvy, I replied. I know that, mate, he responded curtly, but strawberry or orange? Orange, please, I said mournfully, with the sun setting behind me, reminding me of a bad egg thrown haphazardly into a darkening bin. I end my first day on this sodden beach. On this very day, 397 years ago, something unspeakably dreadful happened. But what? I spot a congealed chip on the worn beach, pick it up, suck on it, and struggle to remember.
Wonderful. A minute or so of the late W.G. Zabart on the beach in Suffolk, and as impersonated by my guest today, Craig Brown. I think you ran into him after you published that parody,
yes,
Craig.
In those days, which is probably 15 years ago, I was rather more sheepish than I am now. I'm now more brazen when it comes to meeting my, as it were, victims. Yes, he came and spoke in Albury, and in fact, I think my parody of him had come out in Private Eye about a fortnight before, and even if people don't subscribe to Private Eye, they're soon alerted by friends that they're or enemies that they're in it. And so I didn't tell him, and in those days I was also doing them anonymously, so I didn't tell him that I was the perpetrator of this foul parody. But after he died, I think, a couple of years later in a car crash, and in two of the obituaries, it said he'd particularly enjoyed this parody. So I then felt, oh, that's silly of me not to have, you know, come clean.
I suppose you must go round parties feeling somewhat nervous, and not without reason, because Harold Pinter was not amused, was he?
No, Harold Pinter wasn't well known for his sense of humour, particularly not regarding himself. And I've been doing Harold Pinter parodies ever since I was about 14, I think. And so in some way he'd become aware that I did. And across a crowded party, I looked, and in some ways he must have been psychic, because 200 yards away or something, I suddenly saw Harold Pinter with his hands on either side of his head, doing this sort of schoolboy thing of sticking his tongue out and doing an awful sort of grimace. And he said to our hostess, is that who I think it is? And she said, she confirmed that it was, and she said, oh, do you want to hit him? And he said, I wouldn't dirty my fists. That's my little part of literary history.
Well, let's return to music and a composer that I think you feel, Craig, and actually I feel, should be better known, John Field.
Yes, this is John Field. I first encountered him in Ireland when I went on as a journalistic trip when I was probably about 21, 22. And he's sort of lived with me ever since. He's most famous, I suppose, as the inventor of the nocturne, but still I play him probably rather too much because I find him very kind of contemplative, mesmerizing, magical.
Thank you.
Benjamin Frith playing the Nocturne No. 11 by John Fields. And this programme's coming from London's Southbank Centre as part of Radio 3's residency here this month. He was known as the Irish Chopin, and in fact, Chopin took up the idea of nocturnes after Fields, so he was quite influential.
And would you be able to tell, in a sort of blind tasting, as it were, would you be able to tell Field from Chopin? I suppose you'd know all the Chopin, so you'd...
Well, at the risk of being parodied, Craig, I think I might. but it's very, you know, I think it's great music.
Yeah. But is he up there with Chopin, or you'd put him a few levels down?
I don't know if I'd put him quite up there, but it's very close. I mean, the music is very high quality, very inventive, and has that sort of easy charm and elan which one associates with Chopin. Actually, Field was quite a character, very fond of jokes and puns, and it's even rumoured that he was punning on his deathbed.
I suppose you could say, well, he's not melancholic from that. I mean, it's maybe a very gentle melancholy, but you wouldn't know that he was a punster, necessarily. Or is there something in the melodies which suggests punning?
No, I wouldn't necessarily know that from the music. Well, Gluck, sung by Kathleen Ferrier next.
Yes, I love Kathleen Ferrier. I mean, I'm obviously not alone in that. She is very popular. And I think you could almost call her the first sort of crossover artist, kind of ghastly term that's used nowadays. But she did get into the charts. She outsold Frank Sinatra with this song. And, I mean, nowadays, crossover artists, ones who appeal to classical and popular markets, tend to be in the classical range, very sexy, and that's part of the thing, or they've been on The X Factor or something like that. She obviously wasn't like that. She was a serious singer. But there was something, I suppose, about her Englishness and just about her voice being so reflective of her character. Peter Piers, in his tribute, said, "A voice is a person," and he was talking about her. And you feel that great sense of kind of courage and warmth coming from her voice.
Is left.
Kathleen Ferrier singing the aria that made her famous, really, the Lament of Orfeo from Gluck's opera. And the London Symphony Orchestra was conducted by Malcolm Sargent. We've got a master of a comedy next, Craig. We were talking just now about crossover, and I can't imagine Kathleen Ferrier cross-dressing, but our next artist thrives on it.
Though, of course, this is Barry Humphries. This is him as Dame Edna Everidge. The extraordinary thing about him, he's not like a drag artist. You take it on board that this is Dame Edna, no matter how ridiculous Dame Edna might be. And the fascination isn't, oh gosh, this is a man being a woman. He just becomes Dame Edna. And I chose this because obviously it's spoken word, though he does do songs, or she does, because I think it's a Dame Edna Everidge live before an audience, and it's an example of someone playing an audience like an orchestra, I think. Mm. You can just see him using this kind of nonsensical chit-chat between him and the audience. All comedians do it nowadays. Mm. They chat to a member of the audience about this and that. But he was doing that, you know, probably in the late 50s, certainly when I first saw him in the sort of mid-70s.
There's a woman sitting back there with glasses on. You're turning around and looking. You've just taken your glasses off. Oh, I can see you in the... What's your name?
Mary.
Hello, Mary? Yes. Did you go to the hairdresser this morning, Mary?
No.
Didn't think so. The thing is, Mary, they're very rude, aren't they, darling? You don't need to go to the hairdresser. Your hair falls naturally, darling. All over the armrest, by the looks of it. And I love your frock, Mary. What is it? It's cool and lovely. What is it, darling? What's the fabric? You don't know? It's a lovely dress anyway. It's blue, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's obviously an old favourite anyway, Mary. You watch your manners. There's a woman here. Little Mary, she's come to the theatre tonight and she's gone to a bit of trouble. Not a lot of trouble. But a bit of trouble. What part of London are you from, Mary?
Not.
You're not? Where are you from, dear?
Kent.
Kent? Oh, how beautiful. The Garden of England, Mary. What part of Kent?
Ashford.
Ashford. I don't know, Ashford. By the way, aren't I rude? Excuse me. Muriel, I didn't catch where you were from, darling. Where are you from?
London.
London, are you? And is... Well, what about little Gareth? London too? What a coincidence! Isn't that funny? Isn't that extraordinary? Both from London and both late. Never mind. May I introduce you, Gareth and Muriel? This is little Mary, and she's from Ashford in Kent. And she managed to get here on time. Anyway, no, please.
Barry Humphries, from a live recording in 1976 of his show Edna Everidge, Housewife Superstar.
I love the way he plays with the audience. I love the way he's very rude about someone, and then he blames it on the audience, saying, don't be so rude, remember you're out, all that kind of thing. Mm. And just the way he conjures something out of nothing. It's very pure comedy, in a way.
Barry Humphries, of course, created the character which then rather took him over. And some of your characters have had a sort of life that's taken off. I'm thinking of your columnists. You had a right-wing duffer in The Telegraph and a lefty in The Guardian. Both of them ended up being mistaken by readers for real people, and indeed made it into Who's Who.
Yes, they came into Who's Who on their own accounts, so they sort of transcended me. For instance, the Marxist historian Eric Hobsbawm, I was told by someone at The Guardian, at a Guardian lunch, he said to another Guardian writer, well, I used to know Belle Littlejohn in the 60s, but she seems to have gone off a bit. But of course, you want people to get the joke, otherwise there isn't. If you thought she was just another tedious Guardian writer, what's the point of reading her? You might as well just get Polly Toynbee's sister or something like that. And so you want people to split their brains in two, and one half of the brain to know it's a joke, and the other half to kind of go along with the imaginary reality.
I can see why our next composer, Eric Satie, would appeal to you, because he kind of... one sometimes felt was having a joke on his audience, although the music is strangely elliptical.
Yes, it is. It's kind of mysterious. But also you could, I can see when it, especially when it first appeared, now it's very kind of current, everyone knows it. It's a sort of background music in a way. But I could see that it would be rather shocking because it seems so simple and repetitive.
Well, it was almost minimalist before minimalism came into vogue.
But I'd imagine that you'd know better than me that when it's first performed, people thought, no, this is kind of kiddie music. You're having us on a bit. And he was a sort of Dadaist.
I was going to say.
I suppose in some ways he was having them on, but perhaps it's transcended its joke. It certainly has for me. I love him.
Eric Satie, the first Nociad, played by Pascal Roger. Interesting that music has such an effect and yet is so economic.
Actually, when I was just listening just then, it seemed to be very solitary, actually. I mean, it seems he lived alone and wouldn't let people come into his flat. And you can sort of feel that in that music.
But I think it is fascinating that so much of your music has this slightly desolate feel to it.
Yes, I don't really like humour in music, and even humorous parodies. You can only listen to them once or twice. In classical concerts, you sometimes have the pianist or whoever it is coming on at the end and doing what they call a jeu d'esprit, and I always dread those. And then the audience laughter is always a bit artificial. It's sort of, you know, sort of as if they don't really find it, but so everyone's pretending to find it amusing. I sort of feel that music is for sadness rather than happiness.
It's interesting how much good comedy is based on tragedy, and that's certainly true of the next piece to a certain extent, because you asked for Kenneth Williams reading yes. Edward Lear.
Yes, another person who, well, he lived with his mother but wouldn't invite people up to his flat, a very lonely figure, and this is him reciting the Dong with the luminous nose. Edward Lear himself was much more gregarious, but had this awful fact at the centre of his life, which would he'd have five or six epileptic fits a day, extreme epileptic fits, and only his family knew about it. He had very close friends who didn't know, so he too had this very solitary life. And so this is rather a marvellous union of performer and writer.
When awful darkness and silence reign over the great Grombulian plain, through the long, long wintry nights, when the angry breakers roar as they beat on the rocky shore, when storm clouds brood on the towering heights of the hills of the Shankly Bore, then through the vast and gloomy dark there moves what seems a fiery spark, a lonely spark with silvery rays piercing the coal-black night, a meteor strange and bright, hither and thither the vision strays, a single lurid light. Slowly it wanders, pauses, creeps, anon it sparkles, flashes and leaps, and ever as onward it gleaming goes, a light on the bong tree stems it throws, and those who watch at that midnight hour from hall or terrace or lofty tower cry as the wild light passes along, the dong, the dong, the wandering dong through the forest goes, the dong, the dong, the dong with a luminous nose. Long years ago, the Dong was happy and gay till he fell in love with a Jumbly girl who came to those shores one day. For the Jumblies came in a sieve, they did, landing at eve near the Zemmery Fid, where the oblong oysters grow and the rocks are smooth and grey. And all the woods and the valleys rang with a chorus they daily and nightly sang. Far and few are the lands where the Jumblies live. Their heads are green and their hands are blue, and they went to sea in a sieve. Happily, happily passed those days while the cheerful Jumblies stayed. They danced in circlets all night long to the plaintive pipe of the lively Dong in moonlight, shine or shade. For day and night he was always there by the side of the Jumbly girl, so fair, with her sky-blue hands and her sea-green hair, till the morning came of that hateful day when the Jumblies sailed in their sieve away and the Dong was left on the cruel shore, gazing, gazing forevermore, ever keeping his weary eyes on the pea-green sail on the far horizon, singing the Jumbly chorus still as he sate all day on the grassy hill. Far and few are the lands where the Jumblies live. Their heads are green and their hands are blue, and they went to sea in a sieve. But when the sun was low in the west, the Dong arose and said, what little sense I once possessed has quite gone out of my head. And since that day he wanders still by lake and forest, marsh and hill, singing, oh, somewhere in valley or plain might I find my Jumbly girl again. Forever I'll seek by lake and shore till I find my Jumbly girl once more. Playing a pipe with silvery squeaks, since then his Jumbly girl he seeks, and because by night he could not see, he gathered the bark of the twangum tree on the flowery plain that grows, and he wove him a wondrous nose, a nose as strange as a nose could be, of vast proportions and painted red, and tied with cords to the back of his head. In a hollow, rounded space it ended, with a luminous lamp within suspended, all fenced about with a bandage stout to prevent the wind from blowing it out, and with holes all round to send the light in gleaming rays on the dismal night. And now each night and all night long, over those plains still roams the dong, and above the wail of the chimp and snipe, you may hear the squeak of his plaintive pipe, while ever he seeks, but seeks in vain, to meet with his jumbly girl again. Lonely and wild, all night he goes, the dong with a luminous nose, and all who watch at the midnight hour, from hall or terrace or lofty tower, cry as they trace the meteor bright, moving along through the dreary night. This is the hour when forth he goes, the dong with a luminous nose. Yonder over the plain he goes, he goes, he goes, the dong with a luminous nose.
Kenneth Williams reading Edward Lear's The Dong with the Luminous Nose. You can find the details of all of the recordings we're using on the Radio 3 website on the Private Passions page. Of course, that is another desolate love song, really lost love.
Yes, and I think Kenneth Williams does that so beautifully because it's half funny and nonsensical, but then within the nonsense, there's this awful, desolate, mad quality and frightening, you know, and when he raises his voice, as a child, I wouldn't have wanted to hear that. I'd be very frightened by it.
We're going to plough the same furrow, Craig Brown, because you've chosen another very famous lament. We heard Kathleen Ferrier with the Gluck earlier, and this is another aria she sung, Dido's Lament. But in fact, you went through various versions, didn't you, before you chose this one?
Yes, and I've chosen two songs which I've heard recently at funerals, and for me, who's someone who usually has music on in the background, at funerals it becomes incredibly intense, and the right song for the right person, sung by the right person, is just sort of completely overwhelming.
Which is the recording you've chosen, though?
I've chosen one by Lynn Dawson. I chose her because I thought she gave the sparest performance than the purest. Some of the others have rather overstrong, reverberating voices, and this seems as almost as if it's fading away.
Thank you.
Dido's Lament, When I Am Laid in Earth, from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, sung by Lynn Dawson with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, conducted by René Jacobs. All of these laments, Craig.
I know. but it's, that was just so beautiful. And actually, she sang it amazingly, purely. And I love the way it seemed, it's sort of drifting away from you all the time. It's doing exactly what it's meant to be.
You recently published a book called One on One, which isn't satire. It's a series of real historical encounters between famous people, James Dean and Alec Guinness, Groucho Marx, and rather incongruously, T.S. Eliot. And one of the meetings that you record is between two competing musicians, Rachmaninoff and Harpo Marx. I mean, it sounds like a comedy sketch, but it was, in fact, a real meeting.
Yes, and I had to write the book in quite a flat style because it was all true, and it was this extraordinary daisy chain of meetings. But you would go from Mark Twain met Helen Keller, Helen Keller met Martha Graham, Martha Graham met Madonna. So in three handshakes, you go from Mark Twain to Madonna. Or Rasputin, who my wife has just written a biography of, Rasputin's murderer, Felix Yusupov, met Noel Coward. Noel Coward met Paul McCartney. So you go from Paul McCartney to Rasputin in three. So I had Tolstoy meeting Tchaikovsky. Tchaikovsky was actually very kind to Rachmaninoff and was one of the examiners when he was passing out of the Moscow Conservatoire. Anyway, 43 years later, Rachmaninoff, being in exile in America, was staying in this bohemian hotel, summer 1931, in Los Angeles. And next door to him, in the next door chalet, was Harpo Marx. Harpo Marx was actually quite a serious harp player, and he wanted to practice on his harp. He was there first, and suddenly you had Rachmaninoff on his piano practicing, and they were both really irritating each other because they were both interfering with each other's music practices. Harpo Marx complained first about Rachmaninoff. Rachmaninoff refused to budge. So Harpo Marx, who was very clued into music, knew that the one piece that Rachmaninoff loathed most of all was the piece that had made him famous, which is true of one-hit wonders in the pop charts these days. They hate this one, which they have to do over and over again. And Rachmaninoff, for those last 43 years, had to play the prelude in C-sharp minor over and over again, so going to hate it. So Harpo Marx started on his harp, just playing over and over again for 2 or 3 hours, just the prelude in C-sharp minor. And eventually it was Rachmaninoff who had to leave his chalet and Harpo won. Thank you.
Vladimir Ashkenazy playing Rachmaninoff's Prelude in C sharp minor. It was a double victory for Harpo, wasn't it, actually?
Yes, because then later he was filming, is it Night at the Opera or Day at the Races, whichever film it was, 6 years later, where he was in a battered top hat playing a piano with increasing ferocity. And the more he plays it, the more it gets wrecked, until eventually it just ends up the plate of the piano, which he then plays like a harp. And the piece that he plays is Rachmaninoff's Prelude in C-sharp minor.
Here's a moment of it, and I think he thought of this as Rachmaninoff.
Admit actually that when my wife obsessively practices different pieces, and she reminded me yesterday that was the only piece that I've just got fed up with. So in that way I wanted to do what Harpo did.
You have actually quite a bit of music in your home because your daughter Tallulah has a group, the Vagabond
yes.
Trills.
My son Silas is also musical, plays piano and guitar. And throughout their life, they've loved this thing in the car. They ask me to sing a note or to echo a note, and then they howl with laughter when I can't. So I'm completely tuneless, but I am blessed with a musical family. And my daughter, since age about 16 at school, has had four friends, and they have a harmony group called the Vagabond Trills. They do all kinds of music, but this one we're going to hear is another Saturday funeral piece. My daughter Tallulah worked with, just once in Aldborough, with Roger Lloyd Pack, the actor, who died a month or two ago. And he died of cancer, and so could plan his own funeral, knew he was dying. And so after he died, his widow said to Tallulah, could her group sing The Water Is Wide at his funeral?
The water.
The Vagabond Trills, Alicia Lawson, Imo Berman, Serafina Darby, and Tulula Brown singing the old folk song, which Radio 3 audiences probably know better as O'Whaley Whaley. Being a satirist, I don't get the impression that you take a pessimistic view of life, Craig, but do you?
A sadistic view.
No.
I thought you said a
pessimistic.
Oh, pessimistic. Perhaps I was just thinking you. No, I don't think I do. I mean, you see, obviously I specialise in uncovering human folly, but I think I'm quite merciful. In fact, someone I parodied, I think last week in Private Eye, a kind of pretty ghastly left-wing columnist called Laurie Penny. She then tweeted, which I thought was the first witty thing she said. She said she'd enjoyed the parody and she thought, when the revolution came, I should have a merciful execution. And so I think she probably got that about right.
Well, I think on that note, we ought to grant you a merciful release to return to your pyjamas and your pen and your darkened room. So, Craig Brown, thank you very much for joining me here at the Royal Festival Hall for this special edition of Private Passions.
Thank you.
Michael Barclay's guest today was the satirist Craig Brown. The producer was Elizabeth Burke for Loftus, and you can download that programme, and indeed many others, if you go to the podcasts page of the BBC Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael's guest is the jeweller Theo Fennell. Well, a very good afternoon from me, John Shea. We're live on the south bank of the Thames once again. About half an hour ago, the clouds were looking rather threatening outside, but they've been sent on their way, and the sun has just started to break through. Here in the Royal Festival Hall foyer, there's a crowd of Radio 3 listeners sitting avidly reading the papers and listening to us on headphones. Someone's even brought a dog. Well, all life forms are welcome, so do drop in and pay us a visit if you're passing. We're near the cafe and the ticket desk overlooking the river, and it would be very good to have your company. Lucy Skeeping is here in an hour's time with a live edition of the Early Music Show. Also live this afternoon, the choir with Sarah Moore-Peach at 4 o'clock, and this week's selection of words and music on the theme of British rivers is at 5:30. Now, though, it's just after 1 o'clock, time to return briefly to Broadcasting House for the latest news from Katrina Young.
France has become the third country to release a satellite image of objects in the southern Indian Ocean, where a search is taking place for a Malaysia Airlines passenger jet. Officials in Malaysia say the French image was captured on Friday. It shows potential debris about 575 miles north of where objects were picked up by Australian and Chinese satellites. NATO's top military commander, General Philip Breedlove, has described the Russian military presence on the eastern border of Ukraine as very sizeable and very ready. He said there were sufficient Russian forces there to reach the mainly Russian-speaking region of Transdniestria, a breakaway territory in Moldova on the western Ukrainian border. A report says thousands of girls and young women in England and Wales are trapped in gangs and living what it calls desperate lives. The research by the Centre for Social Justice, a think tank looking at poverty and its causes, says female gang members are sexually exploited and regularly have to deliver drugs. South Africa says a British man will be taken to Cape Town from London next month to face trial for arranging the murder of his wife. The South African authorities have been trying to extradite Shriyan Dewani since 2010. He denies the charges. Police in Kenya say gunmen have opened fire in a church in Mombasa, killing 4 people and wounding many more. It's unclear who the attackers were, but officials in Kenya have been warning of an increased threat of Islamist violence. A visually impaired couple from Stoke-on-Trent, who met when their guide dogs played together, have got married. Claire Johnson and Mark Gaffey, who were in their 50s, said they were in no doubt that their Labrador retrievers had brought them together. The dogs guided the couple through the marriage service and also acted as ring bearers. And the weather, there'll be plenty of sunshine and light winds this afternoon. It'll be a largely dry and clear night. There'll be a widespread sharp frost. Tomorrow, a band of rain and brisk winds will gradually spread eastward. But many central and eastern parts of the UK should stay dry with sunny spells. Well, that's the BBC News and Weather. The time exactly 3 minutes past 1.
Thank you to Katrina Young.
So in an hour's time, the life and works of Pietro Locatelli, one of the violin giants of the Baroque. Well, that's the subject of a live edition of the Early Music Show here at the South Bank Centre, presented by Lucy Skeeping. That's at 2. Before that, today's Radio 3 lunchtime concert, and this afternoon it's just a single work, the String Quintet in C by Schubert. Like so many of his late works, it's a substantial piece, 50 minutes or so, and the slow movement, the Adagio, is a particular highlight, transporting us to the distant realm of E major. Unlike Mozart, who adds a second viola in his string quintets, Schubert here follows the example of Boccherini. The extra instrument is a second cello. Well, this performance of Schubert's quintet in C major took place at LSO St. Luke's last Thursday. It's given by the Signum String Quartet with the cellist Nicola Altstedt.